The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, bonus edition, April 11th, 2019. On Thursday morning, Susan Hennessy spoke to James Comey, the former FBI director, at the Verify 2019 conference. They talked about encryption, they talked about China. They talked about the threats to democratic institutions posed by foreign actors and the President of the United States, and Comey responded to the statements made by Attorney General Bill Barr before the Senate yesterday about the opening of the Russia investigation. It's the Lawfare Podcast bonus edition, James Comey at Verify 2019.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here today, and thank you to Director Comey for joining us as well. Obviously, Director Comey is here to have a conversation about cybersecurity. So the first thing I'm going to do is ambush him with a totally unrelated query to sort of clear the decks of, I think, one question that's probably on a lot of people's minds for this on-the-record conversation, and that's that the Attorney General made some interesting, curious remarks yesterday. I have the quote here in which he said that he said that he believes there might have been spying. He wants to make clear he's not saying that improper surveillance occurred. He's concerned about it and looking into it. I'm curious for your thoughts or reactions on how the public should understand Barr's statements and what your sort of response to it is.
I have no idea what he's talking about, so it's hard for me to comment. Maybe the only thing I can say generally is that I think that his career has earned him a presumption that he will be one of the rare Trump cabinet members who will stand up for things like truth and facts and institutional values. So I still think he's entitled to that presumption. Language like this makes it harder. But I still think he's entitled to that presumption. And because I don't understand what the heck he's talking about, that's all I can say.
Okay. So moving into the actual reason why you're here, I want to sort of open by talking about a story that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, I think the last week, in which Amy Hess at the FBI noted that the FBI is undergoing this large-scale transformation. She said it's the largest transformation that the Bureau has seen since 9/11, sort of focus agents on this sort of issue of cybercrime. Jim Baker is in the room somewhere here. He's made the observation that there's not a telephone division at the Bureau, that cyber is just sort of part of everything. So I'm curious if you can walk us through at a sort of high level how the Bureau conceptualizes cyber. Is it a part of everything? Is it a specific priority? Is it a discrete issue set?
Yeah, this is something I spent a lot of time on during the 4 years that I was there, because this is the single greatest transformation challenge the Bureau has faced, certainly in my lifetime. The Bureau was born 100 years ago during the breathtaking transformation that the automobile posed to law enforcement, right? Imagine that period when the Bureau came of age in early 1920s. Criminals were suddenly moving at breathtaking speeds across distances we couldn't imagine. Right, 45, 50 miles an hour, going from Indiana to Illinois to Iowa in the same day. And all of a sudden, a law enforcement community that was state line bound, county line bound, couldn't deal with this kind of threat. The Bonnie and Clyde threat was transformative. And so the Bureau was in a way born to deal with that threat. As Jim Baker said in talking about telephones, I would adopt for automobiles. The challenge for the FBI was you couldn't have an automobile division where people, a few people learned to drive and they were based in headquarters. And then if criminals were traveling from state to state with automobiles, you sent them out to track them down. You had to integrate the new technology, the automobile, into everything the FBI did. Everybody had to learn to drive at those breathtaking speeds. Now take this transformation and compare it. This is people moving at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, and it erases not county line and state lines, but all jurisdictional lines, because the offense can be committed in one part of the world and touch 100 other parts of the world nearly instantaneously. So it affects everything the FBI does, because all crime has a digital element. All crime can be committed using the internet or assisted by the internet or involves stealing something that is digital in nature. And so to deal with that, the Bureau has to get smarter, faster, more integrated within itself and with the rest of the world, and somehow do that while the threat is evolving at incredible speed as well. So that's the big challenge for the FBI. Right now, there's a cyber division at headquarters, so it's almost like the automobile division, and then there is cyber expertise placed in the field offices around the country and around the world. But if all offenses, not just terrorism, but espionage offenses, criminal offenses are being committed in the digital world, to deal with that, you have to disperse the expertise and the equipment the expertise needs much more widely than that. So that's the pivot the FBI is trying to make, while also trying to attract talent that's really hard to attract to low-paying jobs where you occasionally are asked to work for a month for free.
So you referred to sort of this evolving threat. I'm curious of what that evolution looked like over the course of your tenure as director.
The threat touched every part of the FBI's responsibilities. We saw, obviously, a tremendous amount of criminal conduct through the internet, because that's where everything we value is. It's where our children play. It's where our money is. It's where our secrets are. And so people who would hurt our kids, steal our money, steal our secrets, that's how they come. And so the Bureau had to deal with that, obviously, across our criminal responsibilities. During my time as director, we had an explosion of the use of social media to proselytize by terrorist organizations, especially the so-called Islamic State, to recruit and to direct terrorist activity through the internet. That was a big change. And we saw an explosion in nation-state adversaries and near nation-state actors using the digital vector to steal all kinds of information and to prepare things that were near to kinetic acts of war. And so the growth of the nation-state actors and of the terrorist organizations was the biggest phenomenon I dealt with as director. But again, given that we've connected our whole lives to the internet and the FBI is responsible for protecting people's lives and property, everything we were responsible for was being threatened and challenged in that vector.
When you look back, do you think that there were missed opportunities? Or sort of whenever you look back over the evolution, do you think we should have gotten to that earlier? We could have done something differently?
Oh, sure, plenty. I think I failed to push us to the decision point of how do we want to deploy against this threat aggressively enough. That is, I never got to the place where we made the key decision about should we have a cyber division at headquarters or should we blow it up and push that expertise all the way out into the field. And I think my successor, Chris Wray, is wrestling with that now. I wish I'd gotten to that really hard decision earlier. I think we failed to do an adequate job of pushing the information flow across the semi-permeable barrier between the government and the private sector. We're nowhere near where we need to be there. 80% of the internet in the United States is in private hands. That's great. But that means nearly all the information you need to understand the threat, to investigate the threat, and to stop it is outside the government's control. And figuring out how to get information from the private sector to the investigators who need it, and the other way, is a big challenge, and I don't think we made enough progress on that during the time I was in the FBI.
So while you were there, the government more generally did sort of start to adopt, I think, what it calls the whole of government strategy in responding to cyber threats, one element of which is sort of the name and shame strategy of bringing indictments against individuals. We're seeing that still play out now. There's recently been these arrests and indictments of Chinese nationals. And so I'm curious, sort of with the benefit of time and some development, particularly of sort of the name and shame strategy, do you think that it's been borne out as an effective tool?
I don't know. I don't, for two reasons. I don't know that we have a long enough track record of using that technique. And also because I'm outside of government, I can't see, especially the way the nation state actors like China or North Korea or Iran have responded over the last few years to that naming and shaming. We saw an immediate pivot in the Obama administration by the Chinese agreeing to accept our framework that there's government activity on the internet to steal secrets, and there's criminal activity, which is anybody stealing innovation in order to commercially exploit it. And we saw, as a result of their recognizing that framework in the wake of the name and shame, a dramatic drop in Chinese actors stealing stuff to make money off of it, government-associated actors. I gather from the reporting done by some of the folks in this room that has come back up, but I don't know that for a fact. So that's a long way of saying, I think in the short term, especially with the Chinese, we saw a change in behavior as a result of calling out the behavior, but I don't know whether it has slid back to where it was or not.
Sort of thinking back to 2013, right, the period of time in which we might have been preparing for what came in 2016, especially sort of on the technical dimensions, what would you have done differently, sort of knowing what we know now about disinformation, about the way the threat materialized? What could have been done earlier that would have been different, and how might it have been the same, right? What do you still stand behind?
Going back to 2013? Start from there.
Right, exactly. So,
can I decline to accept the appointment as FBI director, or is that?
No.
Okay.
In this
hypothetical, assuming I became FBI director. I, with the benefit of hindsight, the U.S. intelligence community would understand in 2014 and 15 what the Russians were really up to. That is, I think there was a fundamental miss there, and an assumption that the extensive hacking activities that the US and its allies saw aimed at government and near government institutions, that is both political and think tank institutions, that it was traditional nation state intelligence gathering. Had we known at that point that it was actually maybe that plus something very different, which was an intention to weaponize in order to attack the democratic processes in the United States, I think the government might have done something different to get out in front of that. That's the key benefit I see of hindsight. We looked at that conduct and tried where we could to warn organizations without blowing our sources and methods, but we thought of it as we need to warn them that the bad guys are on their network and they're stealing information. If we'd known they were stealing it in order to attack the American election a year hence, I think we would have thought about it and probably acted about it differently.
So we see current government officials sounding the alarm about future threats to the election. I was struck by the fact that the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, used this term, the lights are blinking red, which is a quote from the 9/11 Commission report. Whenever you see and what you're hearing sort of current government officials talk about and warn about, is your perception that we are doing enough to counter the threat?
My perception is that we are not, and I'll start with the most fundamental way. Our executive branch is led by a commander-in-chief, and a response to an attack on the United States, which is what happened in 2016, requires fundamentally that the commander-in-chief understand it, recognize it, and then direct the branch of government that he leads to anticipate it and prepare to stop it or retaliate. Our fundamental problem is I don't see that our commander-in-chief acknowledges that it even happened. And so if you don't acknowledge that another nation attacked you, how could you possibly be doing enough to deal with it the next time? And in fact, your silence is an invitation in many ways for them to do it again. And so I think we need to start there and ask why our president will not acknowledge what his intelligence community has found overwhelmingly. And I gather, once we get the opportunity to see Bob Mueller's work, I accept that Bill Barr's letter accurately portrays it, that Bob Mueller found there was a massive effort to interfere in this election. And so you need to start there, else you have a situation where the great people who've sworn to protect the United States at lower levels in the government are having to act in the absence of presidential direction, and in many ways, in the face of presidential denial of a fundamental attack on the United States. And so, no, I don't think we're adequately prepared, and in many ways, we're inviting it to happen again by virtue of our president's silence.
So in a way, the foreign aspect is actually the easy part of the sort of the disinformation issue, even though it is incredibly complex on its own. Huge parts of the disinformation problem are about domestic speech. And so, you know, I'm curious, as we start to think about the consequences of disinformation in the domestic space and related to elections, when we care about free speech, when we care about sort of preserving integrity, how should we be thinking about it in that context?
Well, the government has to be very careful and thoughtful about how it acts in a realm where it might touch expression in the United States. That is, if you're focused on a troll farm that's in St. Petersburg, there are authorities that can be used there where you're not worried about infringing on free speech in the United States. But once you're talking about domestic communications, the role I see for an FBI is to collect information and then share it in a responsible way with platform providers so they know that these are foreign actors or these are fraudulent accounts, that sort of thing. But the government has to be very careful about how it acts in ways that might touch that expression, even where you think the expression is misleading. Because a whole lot of lying, I hate to burst everybody's bubbles, a whole lot of lying and misleading stuff that goes on that's entirely American. And so you have to be very, very cautious about approaching that as the FBI or the US intelligence community.
So the government is currently sort of organizing itself in response to threats to election security, particularly the infrastructure, sort of threats to the infrastructure. The disinformation piece has been a little bit of a hot potato that I don't think anybody quite wants. Your prior answer sort of appeared to include the premise that the FBI is the agency that is best suited to sort of respond to to own kind of the disinformation problem. Is that accurate? Is that consistent with your thinking?
No, I think the collection of information about what the adversary is doing is the responsibility of lots of different parts of the U.S. intelligence community, obviously DHS and FBI prominent among them. But our collection around the world helps inform that. The hard part is once you gather that information and have a picture of what's going on and who is responsible for what sort of disinformation that's coming from outside the United States in, the what to do about it is the hard part. The good news is, at least in my experience, the platform owners are very, very keen not to have their platforms be a place of disinformation and crime and terrorist recruiting and all the things that the FBI worries about. And so you have a ready partner in trying to make sure that the platforms are fair and free and honest. And so it may just be a question of supplying information to the providers, but even sharing information you have to do in a thoughtful way. Because if you're wrong or you overshare, you might step on speech you shouldn't be going anywhere near.
So Russia, to some extent, does appear to have achieved its goal of undermining some faith and sowing some discord with respect to sort of US institutions, especially as law enforcement finds itself increasingly enmeshed in these sort of basic political controversies, which of course feed into that cycle of delegitimization. What should, especially law enforcement, but really all of us generally, be doing to prevent those harms, to sort of to restore faith in those institutions?
Well, we have to start by recognizing that the truth is a real thing, and the following statement is true. The Russians intervened in our 2016 election with three goals. The first and overwhelming goal was to damage this democracy of ours so it's not a shining city on the hill, so it can't be held up as an example to countries around the world, especially those on the periphery of the former Soviet Union. First goal. Second, to harm Hillary Clinton, whom Vladimir Putin hated and blamed for street demonstrations in Russia in 2011 and nursed that grudge. And third, help elect Donald Trump, somebody they were surprised got the nomination and I think later in the election concluded likely couldn't win, but their three goals were those. We have to start by knowing that is true, because if you don't acknowledge that is true, then the what to do about it becomes all confused, as I said earlier. One of the good things about Attorney General Barr's letter is that it tells us, even without having to read the Mueller report, that the Russia thing was not a hoax, that it was real, and that it is backed, that assessment is backed by hard evidence. It is true that the Russians came after us. They are going to come again because they exceeded their wildest hopes. Right? They dirtied up our election, they damaged Hillary Clinton, and I don't know what the causative relationship is, but Donald Trump was elected president and then refused to accept the findings of his own intelligence community and stood in Helsinki and said he accepts Vladimir Putin's denial in the face of what his intelligence community was telling him that that is true. And so they will be back. So the first thing we all have to recognize, it's true what happened in 16, they will be back in 20. And so we all, as a society, even if our elected president won't recognize it, have to recognize that truth and understand as we report, as we investigate, as we participate as voters, that the Russians will be playing in the 2020 election, trying to achieve the goals they tried to achieve in 2016. So starting with that sense of awareness should be the top level, and then all the rest of what to do about it flows from that.
Sort of turning to more sort of conventional cybersecurity questions, we see the private sector housing these enormous sets of data, and that the pace and acceleration of that increasing all the time. We're seeing those data sets being targeted not just by criminals, but by nation states as well. So I'm interested from your perspective, what are they after? What are these sort of malicious actors after in targeting these large data sets?
Well, you mentioned the criminals. I'll get that out of the way quickly. The criminals want personally identifiable information, especially your credit card information, so it can be sold on the dark web and monetized, and that's fairly obvious. What's harder to figure out is, so what do the sophisticated nation state actors want with large data sets? And I think there's one thing they want that a lot of the media has focused on, and I think there's a second thing that's gotten less attention. The first thing is, they want to use it as traditional adversaries would to see if they can use that data to identify people who might be representatives of the U.S. intelligence community, sources of the U.S. intelligence community, people who might be traveling to that nation state on behalf of the United States. Closely related, they'd like to be able to figure out, can they penetrate, recruit, co-opt people associated with the U.S. government as part of their traditional nation state espionage? And can they especially use it to design espionage campaigns that take advantage of the consistent weakest link in all of our cyber defense, which is human beings? Can they design phishing emails that come from your Aunt Sally with Uncle Joe's vacation to Lake Tahoe that because it's so real to your life, you will click on that to look at Uncle Joe's vacation photos? So that's the first bucket of their activity. And it's sophisticated and fairly easy, though, if you know the business, to figure out. What's more interesting in some ways is the possibility that they're using these data sets to, that's not my car, I swear I took the keys, that they're using these data sets to feed artificial intelligence machines. When you're developing a sophisticated artificial intelligence regime to control your own people, to predict the activities of your own people, or to predict the activities of people around the world, you need information about people. And so it's much more valuable to gather information about human activity outside your own country, Because let's imagine you're in China. You have a pretty good feel because you are collecting tremendous amounts of information about your own people, how they might act, and you've fed that data into your AI machines. But it'd be also very interesting to develop your capability, hypothetically, if you were able to get large data sets from around the world and feed those into your AI machine, you would be much better able to predict, anticipate human behavior because you have so much more data about human behavior. And that's a piece of the puzzle. I'm not here telling you that's a fact. I'm just saying that's a question that should be asked. Is there value for these data sets beyond what we see as the traditional espionage use to feed massive investments in artificial intelligence to understand, predict the behavior of human beings?
Sort of on the subject of government, private sector cooperation or alignment of interest in this area, obviously one of the marquee sort of issues of your tenure as director was this sort of confrontation with Apple over encryption. You took a central role as the director. So I'm curious about two things. One, to the extent that you were representing sort of the FBI's equities and not your own, there are areas in which you wish you could have pushed further and felt sort of constrained by the obligations of your job. And conversely, now that you're a private citizen, are there nuances or has your perspective on the issue shifted?
I actually feel about the same about it. I feel like I entered that discussion in a dumb way. That is, I used to have these regular, I was a big transparency fan, imagine that. And so I used to have these quarterly roundtables with the media, pen and pad, just to make sure they were on the record, they were thinking about and having their questions answered about the FBI in a reasonable way. And just before I did one of those, I saw advertisements by, I think by both Apple and Google that appeared to be, this is my impression, not their words, bragging about the notion that their devices were going to be warrant-proof. And that really bugged me, because I thought, how on earth can they not see the downside of that? There's a lot that's good about that. How on earth can they not see the consequences that will have in a kidnapping case or a child exploitation case? And so I went into my pen and pad and boom, criticized them. And the reason that was dumb was it immediately set it up as a conflict narrative. And if I have one ask of the folks in this room is, issues around cyber in general, issues around encryption are so complicated that there's a danger that people, because it's so hard to sort through the complexity, will see a shiny object in a conflict narrative and go there, FBI, Apple, Comey's wailing on Cook kind of thing. And I let that happen with the way I entered that discussion. And so that was dumb. And I would do that differently if I had the chance. But in the main, I still see the problem the same way. I think we share values, and they're colliding with each other. Right? Both kinds of security. I care deeply about, and did when I was FBI director, the security of your information and my information and my children's information on the internet, about my banking information, about my health information. I care about that security deeply. I also care a whole lot about the security of innocent people, children, communities, nations that are threatened by all kinds of terrible forces and people. And those two kinds of security are, boom, crashing into each other when it comes to this question of encryption. Encryption's a great thing. Right? The FBI encrypts data. I like it. As FBI director, as a private citizen, that I have a device that is very hard to get information off of. Great. But I also know that the entire compact of the United States of America is built on a trade-off. And the trade-off goes like this. Your stuff and my stuff is private unless the people of the United States really need to see it. And then, with adequate predication and the involvement of judges, the people of the United States can see your stuff. They can go through your sock drawer. They can open the trunk of your car. They can open your safe deposit box. They can look in your phone. That's what the founders were doing in creating the Fourth Amendment, trying to find a way to strike a balance. What I see happening, saw it as director and still see it is, we're drifting to a place where that fundamental bargain will change. And what I mean by that is there are increasingly wide swaths of American life that are off limits to judicial authority. where judges have no practical ability to allow the American people to see your stuff, even with extraordinary predication. And maybe that's okay. Maybe we want to rework the bargain. Maybe we don't. But the danger I saw as director, and I still see, is we're just drifting. We're drifting to a place where we're all, because we love our devices, where we're all going to wake up at some point and say, geez, everything's different now. And I just don't think a democracy should drift. I think we ought to have an adult conversation. And I met privately with Tim Cook, had a great conversation with him about it, where it became clear to both of us we share the same values. We see those two things crashing into each other. And we both agreed that neither of us should decide that question. Apple's business is to sell us awesome equipment. Its business is not to try and figure out how should the American people govern themselves, but nor is the FBI's job is to investigate crime, terrorism, and intelligence and counterintelligence offenses. And its job is not to tell the American people how they ought to live. The American people ought to figure that out. The problem is, it's so hard, so susceptible to bumper stickering, and so fed by knucklehead moves like feeding a conflict narrative, that we just found it too hard. President Obama saw this late in his term, and I remember he went to South by Southwest in Austin and said, this is not an area where you ought to talk about absolutes, because neither of these two things should be absolute. This is about trade-offs, which is at the heart of American constitutional government. And so he set us to work in his last year trying to figure out, is there a way to reasonably accommodate both kinds of security? And we made some progress on that, and he ran out of time. And this information is not a font of sophisticated, complicated, multidimensional thinking, and so it has died, sort of, and so we've continued to just drift. Maybe we ought to throw up our hands and just say, okay, we're drifting to a place where the answer for the government will have to be try to hack devices of criminals and terrorists, and the American people are implicitly accepting that they want the dominance of this kind of security over this kind of security, and maybe we end up there. But I just don't think that's a healthy way to deal with a very complex issue. And to the journalists, this is the mother of all issues. President Obama said complex issues. I remember sitting in the Situation Room with him, and he said, this is really hard. This is the hardest issue I've seen in government. And I agree with him, because it touches not just a collision of security, but it involves innovation, philosophy, international relationships, good old-fashioned economic competition. It has national security implications. There's so many dimensions to this that there's a risk that it'll just overwhelm us, and so we'll go on drifting. I don't know exactly what to do about it. What I liked about President Obama's approach was he said, pick a piece of this, because the encryption issue touches data in motion, data at rest, on servers, in clouds, and it also touches devices. He said, start with devices, start with mobile devices, and see if there's a way that we could create a regime that optimizes both kinds of security, that allows judges to order access, but that doesn't create a situation where people have a legitimate fear that by virtue of this access, this protection will be destroyed. Is it possible? And the answer we came back, the entire US, not just the intelligence community, but lots of parts of the civilian government, was you could actually do something. You could build kind of a split key arrangement where you have a key that sits with the US government, a key that sits with the maker of that device, and a key that sits with a non-governmental agency. In appropriate circumstances, where the judge issues an order, the judge could order the keys combined, access to the data is given. And the world would not end in that circumstance. One of my frustrations is this: people saying, if you grant any access, we're all going to die. No, we're not. Right? Apple's able to access its own cloud. Apple's able to access its own devices. The FBI is able to access its own data. Financial institutions are. But we put reasonable protections around those access ports so that we don't unreasonably raise the risk of a breach by somebody who's not authorized. And so we got to a place, we had a prototype for the president and said, you know, you actually could build something. The notion that it's impossible, so we should never talk about it, is just not fair. But then one other thing that President Obama wanted to do and didn't get the time is to just take the temperature down. As I learned in my conversation with Tim Cook, he's a good guy. I'm a pretty good guy. We share the same values. The FBI doesn't hate Apple. Apple doesn't hate the FBI. We do a tremendous amount together to protect Apple and to protect the country. Given that we share our values, is there a way to talk about this that doesn't fit on a bumper sticker that allows us to grapple together towards a reasonable solution? I don't know, but I would sure hope that at some point we'll be able to get back to that conversation. Sorry for that too long answer.
So last month I talked to your successor, Chris Wray, at RSA, and he said that he was stunned by the depth and breadth and nature of the China threat, and that that had been the one thing that entering as director had really been surprising to him. Are you surprised to hear that as his answer, and how do you think we should be thinking about the China threat in a period in which the United States government is obviously becoming increasingly concerned?
I'm not surprised by the answer because Chris was out of government, I think, since 2004. And China is rising, and that's an awesome thing. Great for the Chinese people, in a lot of ways, great for the world. But with China's rising comes a rising threat to the things the FBI is responsible for protecting. The Chinese threat of traditional nation-state espionage and innovation espionage is wide and deep. There's nothing quite like it in the world in its breadth and its sophistication. And it comes at the United States both in digital form, lots of people at keyboards in China trying to break into stuff and steal stuff, but also it's what the NSA would call human-enabled SIGINT. That is, there's lots of SIGINT, signals intelligence efforts to steal stuff through the internet, information or innovation, but there are thousands and thousands of people who are available to the Chinese government who travel to the United States who are potentially available either as witting parts of that effort or unwitting people to facilitate that theft, thousands. And so that makes it a very sophisticated and difficult threat to deal with. And there's also a fundamental mismatch in how we conceive of the world, as I said earlier. Right here in the United States, we have a clear conception. There's the government and there's the private sector. And the two meet through a semi-permeable barrier where we share information and we share that information in established channels, under established protocols, laws, procedures. That line is largely obliterated in China, and it allows China to be much more nimble and agile because it can move as one machine. And it also makes it, in conversations with them, hard for them, and I accept this, I don't think they were being deceitful, hard for them to accept this division. Right? We are stealing stuff on behalf of the Chinese government. The Chinese government is all of it, and so are taking your design for wind turbines, or jet fighter aircraft, or how you're conducting foreign policy, it's all the same thing. We're taking it for the Chinese people. And your notion that some of that is okay, nation-state espionage, and some of it's out of bounds, is just something we have a hard time recognizing. And so you got a huge threat that's wide and deep. You've got a fundamental mismatch in a lot of ways in your conception of the world and the way in which your nation should interact with the world. That's a recipe for confusion, misunderstanding, distrust, and a whole lot of stuff being stolen. So that's a long way of saying, yeah, I get why Chris Wray was blown away by the threat.
So you just talked about China sort of relying on state-sponsored enterprises. We know that the Russians are using troll farms. We began this conversation with a discussion about how the sort of cyber is every element, and it permeates every element of the Bureau. Especially whenever you think about sort of the law enforcement mission, does there need to be nation-specific strategies? Does the way the FBI thinks about the China threat, should that be different than the way they think about the Russia threat or the North Korea threat or the Iranian threat? Or is, or should there be a sort of a collective, comprehensive cyber strategy or nation-state cyber strategy?
I think there has to be both. That is, there has to be an overarching strategy. And I'm going to say something nice about the Trump administration. They at least have come up with a cyber strategy and published it. there needs to be a top-level strategy for the whole of the U.S. government and within the FBI. And then beneath that strategy, right, there's a counterterrorism strategy, but the Islamic State is very different, still is a very different phenomenon than Abu Sayyaf or than the traditional Al-Qaeda. And so beneath the top-level strategy have to be approaches to the threats, because the threats are different. The Iranian threat is very different than the Chinese threat, which is very different than the North Korean threat. And your ability to defeat those threats depends upon your understanding it and bringing to that challenge a different tool set. So both, I would say, top-level cyber threat and a specific approach, strategy for each of those threat actors.
So sort of in a similar vein, recent attack in Christchurch, New Zealand, I think has brought home a little bit about the extent to which the internet is playing a role in radicalizing various forms of domestic and international terrorism. How do you think about the role technology platforms should be playing in combating those types of threats?
Well, the technology platforms are where we live today. It's where, depressingly, increasingly our social lives, not mine, but normal people's social lives are, that in a cool way and in a disturbing way, it's made everybody a next door neighbor to everybody else. And so there's a lot great about that, but there's a lot of danger in that, because it brings crazy people and dangerous people close to each other and allows them to use those platforms to recruit, to share information and plans, to direct, to control, and so that's a bad thing. The good news is, and I saw this in the fight against the Islamic State, the platforms do not want their services used for ill. Right? They don't want pedophiles on there, they don't want terrorists on there, they don't want extremists of any kind on there. It took a while, I think, for a platform like Twitter to start to really get up to speed in trying to keep the Islamic State from using its platform for ill, but they got there in a pretty good way. I would say one of the things that's responsible for the diminution of the threat in the United States over the last few years was Twitter being much more aggressive about shutting down that platform as a vehicle for these terrorists. That plus the work of the US military in taking the fight to where the keyboards actually were so that they wouldn't be able to sit there and use the platform in that way. And so the good news is the platform providers want it that way. And I don't think, look, it's a discussion we would sometimes have inside the government. Should we go to a place like a crack house statute? I don't know how many of you know that, but there's a federal statute. This is starting to get a little bit annoying. I'm sorry for that. That's not, you're hearing that too, right? Okay. There's a statute that makes it a federal crime for someone, the owner of a dwelling, to allow the dwelling to be used for the distribution of drugs. And it was created in the late 80s to get at the proliferation of crack houses in inner cities around the country, where the landlord would say, it's not my thing, I'm not selling drugs. And so by making the landlord criminally liable for conduct going on in that building, the idea was that's how you push out the drug trade. And so from time to time, there have been conversations that I've heard inside the government about, should we have such a thing for social media providers? That is, that if they're not part of terrorism, they're not part of pedophilia, but if they know their thing is being used for that, should they be criminally liable? I don't think there's a need to go there. And maybe one of the reasons the platform providers are so enthusiastic about policing their own systems is because they fear we would go there if it got that bad. But I think the good news is their interests are aligned with those of law-abiding people everywhere. And the challenge for a Twitter was to invest, to hire the people, invest in the human beings to police the system and kick people off of it when it came to the Islamic State, and they got there.
So you have a room of journalists and sort of editorial decision makers in this room. What do you wish the media had a better grasp of, either generally in this space or specifically in sort of covering and describing the threat that state-sponsored attacks on our institution pose? That sort of specific question.
Well, let me start with respect to cyber generally. I think it's important for media, all of us, including folks in the media, to recognize that there's a lot of nodding when it comes to cyber, cocktail parties and conferences, and most people have no idea what they're talking about. And so you just have to be so careful to triangulate, to figure out, is this person who's giving me this about this particular threat that's coming in this particular way really knows what they're talking about? Because there's a lot of faking it when it comes to cyber. And I don't mean that the people are trying to defraud you. It's just, it's complicated. And a lot of people who sound good, it's sort of like becoming a parent and realizing your own parents really didn't know what they were doing. That there's a lot of not knowing what you're doing but pretending you know what you're doing in cyber. So I would be careful there. The second thing is, I would hope that folks in the media would embrace complexity, that these are hard issues, but the alternative to embracing the complexity is going with the conflict narrative. Instead of wrestling with the issue, I see so many of these articles, there's a hard issue, and it used to happen to me, and then it pivots to is there a fight between the FBI and Apple? Is there a fight between DOJ and FBI about this position? When the thing is should be about this very complicated issue. And so finding a way, and I know this is easier said than done, to resist the bumper stickering and the easy conflict narratives and embrace the complexity is probably my greatest wish for coverage of things related to cyber. And I'll say one other thing. Maybe you all get this already, but cyber is not a thing. It's just a way. It's the way threats come at us. And it's the reason the FBI ultimately has to pivot to embed the resources everywhere, because people want to harm children used to have to go stand outside a school. And they don't have to do that anymore. They can go through the internet and try and get that child to take a picture of him or herself that pedophile can then use to coerce that child. To rob banks, you used to have to actually go to the bank and stand there with a gun and a mask. Now you go and try and steal the money, either through fraud or through some sort of penetration. And that's true of all the bad things people can do to each other. And so cyber is just a way bad things come at us. And I hope that seeing it that way stops a little of the nodding. Because I worry sometimes people just nod cyber, like, I have no idea. Is it an acronym? I don't know. What the hell does it stand for? But it is, it's not that complicated at its core. You've connected, I have too, our entire lives to the internet. And so people want to hurt us, steal our money, hurt our kids. That's where they come. And the threat, I should have said this earlier about the threat, a term that's confusing sometimes is people talk about what is the surface area of the threat. And I think what that simply means is we're now going to connect our running shoes to our refrigerator, to the shirt we wear while we run, so that they can talk to each other, so that the water is cold when you get back after running. And all that's kind of cool. And then when you leave, the thermostats will change. That's great. But all that is connected to the internet. And so people want to hurt you, steal your money, hurt your kids, they have more ways to come in. If they can find a way, a weakness in the sneaker design or in your car, then they can break in that way. And because everything is connected, swim upstream. It's to defend ourselves, we need to understand that. And this is, it'll sound old-fashioned, but the single biggest problem you will hear from legitimate cyber experts is nobody checks to make sure that their systems are up to date. Because the challenge of this threat is it moves. There's a Darwinian evolution at incredible speed. Bad guy tries this, doesn't work. So they try a different way. And it's going on all day long. And so the bad guys will find a way to get in. And now the arms race on the other side is the person who made your sneakers is going to try and update that technology to protect against that way in. But so few companies and people actually take advantage of the ability to put that patch on to protect your sneakers or protect your refrigerator or protect your enormous server farm, that it's easy for people to break in because they can come in using the old doors. And so recognizing that it's not that complicated, it's simply a way that they come at us, and that there are sound, simple ways to protect ourselves is, I don't think, too complex for people to get their arms around, and too complex that it'll force them off into a bumper sticker.
So before we open the conversation up to questions, I will take you up on your call to address complex questions by asking a question that I think has a pretty complicated answer, at least to my mind. And that's, what role does the media play in combating information operations? So we're talking about disinformation. I think it's relatively clear, right? You provide true and accurate information. When we're talking about hacked information and presuming that threat materializes in the future, what are the obligations of the media in covering those types of threats without actually amplifying and providing precisely the sort of the coverage and demand for, you know, hacked and illicitly gotten materials that are being distributed in order to sort of undermine institutions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Maybe I would put my answer in two buckets. The first is, well, preliminarily, I don't blame the media for writing about information that's come to them that was stolen, either stolen from an enterprise or stolen from a government. That's the government's problem, and so I don't blame the media for that. But in thinking about how to respond to that, I would put my reaction in two buckets. The first is, it's really important to remember that you're not just a member of the media, you're a human being and, I hope, responsible citizen of whatever country you live in. And so it's really important that none of us casually risk the lives of innocent people. And again, I'll say something else about the media that I say behind the media's back. In my experience, the media in this country is very thoughtful about trying to make sure that they don't stumble into a situation where they expose a source or a method that puts people's lives in danger. All the time, the media gets access to information that's been leaked or stolen or hacked, and before they run with it, check with the government. Say, I've got this thing. You want to make a pitch to me as to why I shouldn't publish it? Do it. And I've had that happen throughout my career, and that's a good thing. And that's not about compromising your independence. Just, you don't want to get innocent people killed. So that's a really important thing to do. My experience, it's done. There were some parts of Snowden that I would characterize as kind of internet porn, where people just pushed it out without checking, but responsible journalists checked and had important conversations. That's the first bucket. The second bucket is, my reaction is, just do your job. And your job doesn't stop with publishing what you got, because that's part of sharing the truth, but there's another truth that has to be reported and maybe was underreported during 2016, and that is, so where did this stuff come from? And what are the motivations behind that? And I know that's tricky for reporters, because that may involve stepping on your own source, but I think that's part of finding and reporting the truth. I got these documents from Susan out behind the 7-Eleven. Okay. So I'm going to report these documents. They're important. They're embarrassing to one party or the other. Okay. But I don't think responsible reporting stops there, else we're missing a big chunk of the truth. Why are you giving it to me? Where did it come from? And what's behind this? And I think a little bit of the Russia angle in 2016, some of it was reported, but there was so much focus on the documents themselves, there's a piece of the truth that may have been underreported. I don't know for sure, but I have that sense. And so my second bucket is, do your job in a great way. Report the truth, which is not just, I got this stuff. It's, where does this stuff come from, and what does it mean, and what are the implications of the fact that it's being given to a reporter to be published? That would be my reaction.
Okay, with that, I think we're calling for, just wait for the microphone to come to you. Natasha.
Thank you, Director Comey, for being here. So I think that's a really good place to jump off from for my next question, which is your reaction to the arrest of Julian Assange today and what you make of the DOJ's decision to charge him with conspiracy to commit computer intrusion and kind of staying away from the questions about, you know, whether or not it was illegal for him to receive classified information and getting into those thorny journalistic questions. And also, whether you think he can be helpful to prosecutors in figuring out, you know, more about what happened in 2016 with the Russians.
Yeah, I got to give you a short answer because I don't know. I don't know enough about his arrest or the underlying indictment to give you a thoughtful comment. And I certainly also don't know or want to speculate about his value to investigators. So I just don't know enough to say, and I shouldn't be making stuff up.
Thomas Ridd, Johns Hopkins. The White House called the NotPetya attack the biggest cyber attack in history. It was only possible because leaked NSA hacking tools were built into this attack by and as a result of an operation that I'm sure you're familiar with known as Shadow Brokers. It started when you were still at FBI in August 2016. What is Shadow Brokers? Who are they? Would I be wrong? Would we be wrong if we assume they're more likely an inside job than a Russian operation?
Yeah, I can't answer that. I mean, I won't answer that. I'm not at liberty to answer that.
Thank you, Director Comey, for being here this morning. I'm Alondra Nelson. I'm a researcher at Columbia University and president of a research nonprofit called the Social Science Research Council that's working with the Hewlett Foundation on a disinformation research project. So I have two questions for you that, you know, answer one or both or not or, or neither. One is about the first goal that you suggested with regards to the Russian disinformation campaign around damaging our democracy. And I wondered if you might say something in particular about the way that racial animus and the creation of racial animus was part of that sort of attack on our democracy, as it's becoming clear from the research that the ways that the Russians were working were about sort of creating a kind of racial decay in the US, if you might say something about that. And then secondly, I was very much struck by your early comments about the need to attract talent, and I wanted to ask if what you might say to us about how researchers can work better with government to anticipate risk, to help ensure that we're not drifting, our democracy is drifting, as you say, in a moment in which so many researchers are going to the private sector. So I think that's there's a kind of brain drain that influences what happens in the federal government. That's not just about salaries. It's really just about building more capacity, building more people who can do this work.
The first part, I think that the special counsel's indictment, and which is why there are many reasons why it'll be so important to get transparency on the special counsel's report, but I think you see a lot in the indictment of the Russian actors that shows that their goal was to find our fault lines and push on them to divide us. And obviously things like guns are an important fault line, but I don't know of a more important and fundamental fault line in the United States since before we were the United States than race. And so it appears, again, from the indictment that there was a concerted effort to exploit that fault line to make us hate along lines where we sometimes hate quickly even without being pushed, but to push. So that's the first thing. The second thing, was there another part to the first thing? You'll tell me. So I'm going to get to the second thing, to the talent part. The challenge is for an FBI is how do we attract and retain talent, especially if we want that cyber talent to be special agents. Because to be a special agent, you have to be smart, honest, and physically fit enough to run, fight, and shoot. And cyber expertise doesn't always check all those boxes. Sometimes it's smart and honest and can't do a push-up. Sometimes it can do push-ups, but it's smoking weed on the way to the interview. And so it's a real challenge. And so you're looking for a bit of a unicorn to begin with. And second, you're looking for that unicorn who has, if they are the person you think they are, they have alternatives that are extraordinary. And I was half kidding, but I'm not only half. You're talking about attracting them to the federal government, paying them $100,000 a year, and then having them deal with things like the indignity and the suffering of not being paid for a month, being derided, and forget this president's efforts to burn down the FBI, which are significant, but be derided in general as government workers. And then something that's more subtle and important, putting them into an FBI that's a very hierarchical, tradition-bound organization, where when that young woman who's 26 raises her hand with a great idea, she may sometimes be told, maybe not even told, but from the body language, like, hey, kid, let us know when you've been here 10 years kind of thing. And so All of that adds up to challenge attracting, but challenge retaining. And I've seen this recently. The FBI turnover stats are extraordinarily low. It's unbelievable. It's about 0.5% for special agents, except for the cyber agents. And the hard conversations they're having are with their families, because I've had these over the years with my amazing family. Like, yeah, dear, we get that you love the mission and everything, but you know, we're five of us living in a one-bedroom apartment here in New York, and JPMorgan Chase is saying they'll pay you $700,000 a year. I can't eat the moral content of your job, honey. And so it really becomes a hard conversation for them. And so the answer has to be that we think about our cyber talent differently and also think about our relationship with the private sector, the academic community, as well as businesses in a different way, because they have the expertise, they have the information. And so that's when I talk about that semi-permeable boundary. We have to find ways to work together more effectively across that boundary. And there are all kinds of cool things that have been going on, but none of them have scaled. And that's our big challenge. Can the FBI, even if it can't hire the talent, in a way borrow that talent and that knowledge, but borrow it in a way that respects the FBI's power and its need to be cabined by a set of rules? Really hard problem.
Hey, I'm Tim Mack with NPR. I wanted to follow up on the Julian Assange question. I know you said you didn't want to speculate about the particulars about his arrest, but there's no shortage of people who view him as a whistleblower or someone who is a journalist. Knowing what we know about his actions, how would you characterize what he's done and what the appropriate way forward might be for U.S. law enforcement?
I got to give the same answer I gave earlier, because I don't know enough about the facts that underlie the...
I'm talking about the facts that we currently know about what he's been involved with, the leaks that he's been involved with, which are not private, which are not involved in the particulars of his arrest.
Yeah, I don't know them well. I certainly don't have confidence that I know them well enough to give you a view. I think it'll be important that he would be entitled to all the due process that being a defendant in an American criminal proceeding gives you, but I don't know enough, and it would be dangerous for me to start giving you views beyond that.
On William Barr's comments, do you feel like he crossed a line yesterday? And on Assange, given President Trump's past praise of WikiLeaks, is there a concern that law enforcement could go easy on him?
The second part first, that's a good question. I don't know, and I would hope that the president would let the Department of Justice pursue a case as it ordinarily would. Obviously, given the track record of the last 2 years, I can't have high confidence that that will happen, but I don't know how that will turn out, and I can't predict, maybe even he can't predict, what the president will say on any given day, so I'll stop there. With respect to Barr's comments, I really don't know what he's talking about when he talks about spying on the campaign, and so I can't really react substantively. When I hear that kind of language used, it's concerning, because the FBI and the Department of Justice conduct court-ordered electronic surveillance. I have never thought of that as spying, and the reason I'm interested to know what he means by that is if the Attorney General has come to the belief that that should be called spying, wow, that's going to require a whole lot of conversations inside the Department of Justice. But I don't know what he meant by that term. And factually, I don't know what he meant, because I don't know of any electronic surveillance aimed, court-ordered electronic surveillance, aimed at the Trump campaign. And so that's the reason for my confusion.
Director, thanks for being here. My question also on Barr's comments this week, and as we're living through this liminal state of him sitting at his desk redacting the Mueller report page by page right now, you know, he's laid out sort of the four categories, three of which make sense clearly in terms of redactions, ongoing investigations, classified sources and methods, 6C, grand jury testimony. And then he has sort of this fourth super ambiguous category of redactions that unduly impugn peripheral third parties that are not criminally charged. And I'm wondering, given your experience in 2016 and dealing with the Hillary Clinton email investigation in July and October, you know, how what advice would you offer the Attorney General in the context of how to balance what information should be made public about its behavior in the Mueller report that doesn't rise to the level of criminal charges?
I don't have any specific advice to offer. I can talk about generally my experience, that there is a category that is a reasonable category. When you offer transparency, and all of you know this, but I'll say it again, the Department of Justice has long offered transparency about the conduct of uncharged individuals in cases of legitimate and extraordinary public interest. Did it after Ferguson, Missouri, did it after the Tea Party cases. I did it after the Hillary Clinton investigation, unless I thought it was completed. The question is, what transparency do you offer? And what you try to do as a department is confine the transparency to the key players, because your goal is that the public has confidence that the work was done in an apolitical way. The Department of Justice, after the so-called Tea Party IRS targeting, criticized the conduct of a woman named Lois Lerner, but didn't name and criticize the conduct of any lower-level people in the IRS. And the reason I believe they did that was she was a key player, and for the public to have confidence that the department wasn't pulling its punches, they need to know the department's assessment of this key player and the department's judgments about whether her conduct was criminal in nature. So they said it was poor judgment and bad management, but it didn't rise to the level of criminal conduct. Very similar to what I said in the Hillary Clinton case, to explain our judgment that this doesn't rise to the level of criminal conduct, we have to explain just what we think it is. Not to attack somebody or disparage them, but to be transparent about the basis for this judgment. But the focus there, and in all the other cases where the department has done it, is always on the conduct of the key players. You'll notice you didn't hear us talk about anybody. I didn't talk about anybody else in that announcement in July except Secretary Clinton, and we tried not to name the people who set up the servers or the peripheral players. That's an important rule of an approach to these kinds of things. Again, consistent with the goal, the public needs to know enough to have confidence this was done in the right way, and the public doesn't need to know about marginal players to understand that and for that goal to be achieved. So that's how I think about it.
Thank you for coming, Director. I wanted to ask you, Adam Schiff is continuing an investigation into foreign financial influence that might have impacted the president and his administration, and the president has been very critical of that investigation. You yourself have been before the House Intelligence Committee a number of times. From a counterintelligence perspective, what is the value of digging into foreign financial influence, and what value do you think that that investigation will have?
Well, I can speak generally, and that is it's important to try to understand from a counterintelligence perspective whether there are links between foreign nation states or those acting on behalf of nation states and key elements of the government of the United States or near government enterprise in the United States for purposes of co-opting or coercing any of that sort of thing. And so it's important as a counterintelligence investigator to understand the nature of any connections. So that's a general principle. As to the investigation itself, I don't have a view, except oversight by the third branch is essential. It's one of the reasons I thought it was so important that at least one House of Congress be controlled by a different party, because we were seeing, as Americans, no meaningful oversight. And the founders designed our system to have interests crashing against themselves. And so it is a great thing, whether you're a Republican or Democrat or neither, for there to be some crashing and some oversight. I know, because I've been the subject of oversight when I've been in government, it's a pain in the neck. It's a great pain in the neck. I believe that even when I was the one being overseen. And so it's a healthy thing for democracy in general. I don't know enough about Chairman Schiff's investigation to have a particular view on it.
Thank you for doing this, Director Comey. It's David Sanger from the New York Times. I wanted to take you back to your conversation about encryption, because it seems to me that the conversation and the complexity that you were embracing really hasn't made a whole lot of progress in the past couple of years. So prior to your statements, you may remember that President Obama had created a commission right after the Snowden revelations, and they came out with a recommendation that basically said the United States government should embrace encryption, help companies do more encryption, help individuals do it, that it was the only way we were going to navigate our way through here. And then you gave your talks, including one at Brookings, I remember, where you made another version of the going dark argument. Might you argue that if the FBI had to choose between very strong encryption, but continuing to have access to all the other digital data you now have, Google Maps locations, cell phone location data, all these other investigative tools, you're actually vastly better off than you were 15, 20 years ago, even if you had encryption you couldn't break?
That's a reasonable question. I believe the premise poses a false choice first, that I don't believe we should ever be in a position where we have to choose one or the other, because I believe that we can operate in a world with robust encryption and effective judicial authority. But I take the point. I've heard it described as the golden age of surveillance, right? That all of us are leaving digital dust all over the place, and law enforcement has access to that in a way we didn't before. That's true. So that's on law enforcement's side of the ledger. On the other side of the ledger is the bad guys have so much better ability to communicate and to hide their communications that in a way just the entire tide has risen. And the challenge for law enforcement in particular is we have to have content to convict, right? You cannot convict a pedophile based on Google Maps locations or digital dust. You need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the nature of the communication. And so that's our challenge as law enforcement. It actually may be a place where law enforcement and intelligence diverge a little bit. There's no substitute for content. And it's becoming increasingly hard for gangsters and drug dealers and pedophiles and terrorists to hide the content in a way that it can't be reached. And so, yeah, there are benefits to the digital dust we all leave. The bad guys have also gotten a lot better. But the challenge for us is none of it gets us content, which is a real obstacle. But I reject the idea that you have to have one or the other, that you have to choose robust encryption, or you have to choose access to content. I believe you can have both. There's all kinds of models that have proven that. I saw Chris Ray give a talk recently about where he mentioned Symphony, which is the network that the major banks use, brokerage houses, to protect their data and their communications. And it is strongly encrypted, but because of their responsibilities to their financial regulators, they also have the ability to access it to comply with judicial process. And I don't hear anybody saying that the banks have not designed a sufficiently robust system. There's risk everywhere, but I don't think it requires an either-or trade-off.
Director Suzanne Spaulding, now with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You talked about how you wish we had understood better, gotten ahead of the Russia's weaponization of information around the elections. I'm worried that we may be missing the boat again around Russia's attacks against the justice system that are ongoing to this day, that you have been a victim of, disinformation, information operations targeting you, Mueller, DOJ, FBI, but also courts, judges, and prosecutors across the country. As we enter a time where this clashing that our founders designed and you know intentionally built, creating potential constitutional crises, whether it's around House subpoenas to the White House or other issues that may come before the courts that are highly emotionally charged, politically divisive, and we need the public to have trust and confidence in the credibility of the court's decisions and respect those. How dangerous is it that Russia may be trying to erode that very trust and confidence in our courts and our justice system? And do you have thoughts on what we do about it? How do we get ahead of that this time?
Thanks, Suzanne. It's great to see you again. My mind actually doesn't go to Russia first when I worry about that threat. It goes to the President of the United States. That I'm sure Russia is engaged in efforts to undermine all manner of American institutions, but the President of the United States tweets and speaks lies about those institutions nearly every day and does it so often that we've become numb to it. And there's danger in that numbness. Right? I wake up some mornings and the president's tweeted I should be in jail. And you know what I do? I laugh. Like, oh, there he goes again. I don't follow him on Twitter, so I only see it if one of you retweets it. But I laugh, and in that laughing is danger. Right? Because I know there's no conceivable basis for it. There isn't even an investigation of me. But the numbness is, holy cow, the president of the United States is announcing that people should be in jail or that the FBI is corrupt. And I haven't yet seen how he's going to navigate his belief that he was fully exonerated by a corrupt institution, but he'll navigate it somehow and navigate it with lies. There's tremendous danger to us in our numbness. And I'm sure you all feel it, that every president makes false statements. Barack Obama did. You like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. George Bush did. Their weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And then you know what we did? We held them accountable because we measured their distance to the touchstone of the truth. And those two men spent the rest of their terms and probably the rest of their lives explaining to us. I didn't know, I thought, I meant, I understood to explain the tether. There's so many lies coming at us now, there's a danger that the touchstone will just wash away. And we will stop measuring our leader and leaders against the truth. And it should be plural because the Republican Party bears some responsibility here. So I'll say something else nice about the media. Thank you for not getting too tired, for continuing to call it out because the truth exists. And to insist that it be examined and there be accountability, but there's danger there. An erosion of those norms at the center of American life. And so I don't even think about, I mean, the Russians are important here. I think about what's happening inside our country, the attacks on the judiciary, the attacks, all of it is dangerous to us and makes it really, really important that we stand up and speak about what we stand for in 2020.
Hi, Director Comey. Thanks for being here. Zolan Kano Youngs from the New York Times. On the topic of Chinese espionage, I'm curious what you think about the recent incident at Mar-a-Lago. You talked a little bit earlier on about certain individuals here domestically who may be used wittingly or unwittingly to carry out maybe certain missions from foreign entities. Based off the evidence that you've seen thus far, what does that situation look like? Do you think that's, does that fall into the carrying out, you know, malware into that location wittingly or unwittingly? And also, just broadly speaking, when the president is traveling to that location as frequently as he is, does that raise a certain exposure level to the threat of cybersecurity? And thirdly, what can be done about that?
I can't tell what that is from the reporting, which is not picking on the reporting. I can't tell. There's lots of reasons why being in the Secret Service is one of the hardest jobs in the world, and that just highlights why it's particularly hard when you have a location like that, that at least according to the press reports, is not secure when the president's not there. So I can't tell. But to me, it highlights something that a lot of companies and government institutions have been slow to realize. The weak link is the people. You can have the best intrusion detection systems, firewalls, patch management, everything you need to protect yourself from your cyber experts have sold you. But if your employees are knuckleheads, many of them are, or they've been co-opted in some way and come in and stick a thumb drive into one of your devices or click on an email, all of that money didn't make any difference whatsoever. And so what I used to say to companies is so many companies divide cybersecurity and personnel security when they are together, right? You can have this great cybersecurity. If you don't know your people and how they're acting and train them in a good way, you've wasted all of this money. And so to me, it highlights, and I was being intentional talking about this with the Chinese threat, what makes the Chinese threat so interesting and so hard, it comes in both of these flavors. But I don't know whether that represents this, but to my mind, it brings to mind this two dimensions to that threat.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hello, Fred Vogelstein at Wired. Thank you for being here. Are the social media companies doing what you'd like them to be doing to reform the way they monitor their platforms, or are there things that you would like to see them do that they're not doing?
I don't know enough about where they are today to answer that in a thoughtful way. I think even they would have said, as of 2017 when I was fired, that they wish they could do more. They wish they could hire more people. They wish they had better systems. But I don't want to say that by way of criticism, because I saw tremendous progress, especially when it came to the terrorism threat, across the social media platforms, trying to find and kick off people who were misusing the systems for that. And I think they had great success against the Islamic State. So it's one of these, you're doing a great job. I'm sure there's more you can always do, but I don't know enough about where it is today. It's almost 2 years since I was fired to know. And I'm sure the threat has changed significantly in 2 years, and the way in which they're responding to it has come up significantly in 2 years, because their interests are aligned with the government's in not wanting them to be misused. That's probably the best I could say about that.
Great. Dr. Comey, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you all. Good luck.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Verify and the Hewlett Foundation for providing audio of the event. If you haven't yet, please share the podcast on Facebook or Twitter and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. Until next time, thanks for listening.